Welcome to Grass Talk Radio. This show is for people who play bluegrass music and anybody who might want to.
The prison guard shut the iron door behind me.
Howdy, folks, and welcome back to Grass Talk Radio. Today we're going to enjoy an interview with a fellow by the name of Matt Hutchinson. He is a fellow podcaster, and he has a very cool podcast called Bluegrass Jam Along. And if you haven't run into that yet, I encourage you to look for it. Just listen to the interview. He will tell you how to find it, and it's pretty cool. And I got him on the show just to talk about, you know, why he was doing it. He's from England. So, you know, it's curious to me about how bluegrass has spread around the globe. And, you know, I was just curious to know why a guy would want to put out a thing called Bluegrass Jam Along. And Matt does a fine job of explaining the whole thing. And we get into a whole bunch of subjects and stuff. And I think it's something you're really going to enjoy. Before we get into the interview, I want to, in particular by name, thank my newest Patreon supporter, Michael Diaz. You know, I rattled off the list in the last episode of all the patrons, and Michael Diaz, thank you, buddy. I do appreciate you, and every little bit counts, as they say. So what you're going to hear, the little segue music, is a bit of music straight off of the Bluegrass Jam Along podcast. So let's hear a little bit of that, and then we will all meet Matt Hutchinson.
One,
so here we go.
1, 2, 3.
Hey, Matt, and welcome aboard Grass Talk Radio. How you doing?
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us, me and the listeners, a little bit about your podcast. And I want to say it's a new podcast because it's fairly recent, Bluegrass Jam Along. Just kind of give an overview about what is the podcast that you're doing.
So it's basically a podcast of fiddle tune backing tracks for people to play along with at home. And it came out of a couple of things. One was me just looking for backing tracks that ran through tunes more than once or twice, just so I could settle into a groove and play. But also, we've all been through a really strange year, and most of us haven't had the opportunity to play with other people. And for me, however much I sit at home and play my guitar on my own, it's never the same unless you can play with people, and I've really missed jamming with people.
Yeah, you're preaching.
So I started recording.
You're preaching to the choir here, brother.
Yeah, well,
I feel it. I feel your pain. I've bellyached at length about this over the last year. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and so I started recording my own backing track just for me to play along to. You know, because it's great being able to play the tune over a bunch of chords somebody else has recorded. But actually, I also wanted something that just had the tune so I could practice playing backup, and then something that practiced switching between the two like you would in a jam. So I started recording these for myself, and I thought, if I feel like this about it, some other people out there will as well. So why don't I just throw them out there somewhere and see if they're useful to people? And a podcast just seemed like an easy way of doing it to me. I didn't have to worry about a YouTube channel or filming anything or understanding a load of technology that I didn't. So I just started putting them out to see what would happen. And people started downloading them and playing along.
Yeah, I suspect that your download counts are pretty high. I'm making that guess because they're fairly short. So a person could discover it and, like, in 15 minutes download all of them, which they wouldn't be able to do on mine because, you know, you get these hour and hour and a half shows and stuff. It would take maybe a couple of weeks to download it all. So I'll bet your counts are rocketing up pretty good, which is probably push you up in the search algorithms, I would imagine.
But it's been interesting because the longer I do it, the more episodes there are, and each new person who discovers it, exactly like you say, they go and download all the previous ones as well.
Yep.
So in the first few weeks, they may have found two or three tracks and downloaded them. If somebody comes to it new now, then I think there's 48 tracks on there now, and people will just download the whole lot. And because they are short, I'm trying not to get in the way. I'm not talking too much. I'm just having a quick intro and then getting on with the backing track.
Right.
They're pretty quick to get into.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I have not listened to all of them. When I first discovered your podcast, you know, I'm always checking out anything that says bluegrass, and it might have even come up, where in the Apple podcast app, it will suggest other podcasts, and that's probably where I saw it. You're looking at a bluegrass podcast, and then it'll throw up two or three other ones that I guess other people have subscribed to and stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, I haven't listened to all of them, but I did listen to enough of them to decide to send you an email and compliment you on the sound of that guitar. And so if you don't mind, take a minute, and we're going to back up to your history and all that stuff a little bit later. But tell everybody a little bit about how you are recording these and, you know, your instrument and that kind of thing.
It's pretty straightforward. Part of the intent in me setting it up was that it didn't take too long to do because I didn't want to spend the time I wanted to spend practicing my guitar on a load of technical stuff, the podcast. So I set myself a rule that I could be set up and recording in 5 minutes. So I use a laptop. I use a USB mic called the Blue Yeti,
yeah,
which is pretty good for mm-hmm. the money. And I use GarageBand on a Mac.
Oh, do you?
And
yeah.
That's it. I set up the mic. I drape a few towels around to deaden some sound, and I record. And I'm definitely helped by the fact that the guitar that I've got is very friendly to a microphone. It's not an expensive guitar at all. It's an Eastman E1D Dreadnought that cost around $500, I think.
Yeah.
It's a cheap guitar, but it's essentially a D18, you know, lookalike.
That's more or less, I think, what I said to you in that email. I said, it reminds me of a D18, and I was talking about, you know, like the kind of tone that Norman Blake used to get. I felt like, wow, maybe I know more about guitars than I thought I did.
And I haven't played too many Martin guitars. I'm not an expert on them, but it's definitely that D18 kind of sound. It's the sides are made of an African wood called sapele.
Yeah.
Which is essentially mahogany,
right,
in another form. And so it has that beard, but it feels like an old guitar. It's super resonant and fun to play, and it's just got a wide open sound. It sounds great.
Yeah, I have sung the praises of Eastman instruments for quite some time when instruments first started. Like, I started way back in the 70s, and when the first, what we called imports, started coming out of Japan and then later Korea and then China, they were pretty iffy. I mean, they looked like instruments, but they didn't sound good. And there's been a change in that in the last, probably beginning about 15 years ago. All of those instruments, from practically everyone that produces them in Asia, have improved dramatically. And Eastman, in my book, is pretty close to the top of the heap as far as, you know, they're really capturing. And in many cases, actually, if you look at the Eastman website and look at the photographs and videos and stuff of their shop, they are literally building them the way they were built in Kalamazoo, you know, back in the teens and 20s. It's amazing how much they've improved. And that thing really sounds good. I am curious, when you record, do you record with any kind of a click? Or is that just your impeccable timing we're hearing?
Yeah, so, well, thank you. The way I figured it would make most use, because the idea is not for me to be, for this to be a super professional. The idea is it sounds like jamming along with a buddy sat on your front porch. Also, I'm not that perfect a guitarist, so it needs to sound real because it is real. So I stick my earphones in and listen to a click, but I don't put the click in the final track.
Yeah. Okay.
So people are playing along with me rather than playing along with a metronome, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to give you praise. That is so difficult to do, to be locked into a click and be attempting to stay with it. Because I think in the real world, when we don't have that, it's somewhat flexible. I mean, we're always modifying and changing just a little based upon what we're hearing, and so is everyone else. And then when you've got that robotic, heartless gnome clicking away, it's easy to feel like it's strange. And so I will just compliment you. I think you're just doing a really good job with the timing of the stuff.
Oh, thank you. And if you listen to the click, if you listen to the track that I'm playing with the click, you will hear that I am wandering around a bit.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, we all do. And I think it's
exactly
important.
Good music does. It breathes.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear you say that. It can get kind of sterile. And it would be curious to put one out with a click, especially one of the tracks where you're playing the lead. Because I think a lot of times, you know, part of the dynamics of music is to push or pull or, you know, work around the beat a little bit, especially in lead playing. Maybe not so much in rhythm, maybe, but I'd be curious. But anyway, I understand how difficult that is because of all the multiple tracks that I've done, you know, and it all starts playing something along with that darn click. And, you know, I get to swearing like a sailor, and you feel like you can't play as well as you thought you did, you know what I mean?
Totally, totally.
Well,
like a little thing in your ear saying no, wrong, no, wrong.
Right, and that is not a good thing when you're playing music. You know, you need to be feeling right. This is good, you know. And it takes some practice. I've always told my students, you know, debating the whole metronome thing, and pushing it, and saying how valuable it is, and how unforgiving it is. But I've always, you know, stressed that when it becomes easy, you're just playing better. When you begin to not hear it, you know, or when you begin to feel like your pick is causing the click, you know, it's like you get so in sync with it, it just disappears, really. It only reappears when you have screwed up.
Anyway. Yeah, because it's not going to screw up.
Yeah, it won't. Although there are people who will swear it's the metronome, especially back in the days of the wind-up, the old Vintner that your piano teacher had on top of the piano with the swinging pendulum. And I think I can even hear that when it's traveling in the direction of the spring, it actually goes a little faster than when it recoils. And so, you know, maybe people could debate whether or not there is any fault in a metronome, but it's still, even the worst metronome is probably better than the average musician.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think one of the things I count myself lucky as is the first instrument I played was drums. And so I spent a lot of time as a kid sort of drumming on my body, like, you know, people do, just tapping my feet and patting my legs on my chest. So I've kind of got rhythm, feels like it's internal now. And it's one thing I don't think about anywhere near as much as I think about the tone I'm producing or how I'm fingering a phrase or what my pick's doing or...
Right.
You know, rhythm's the last thing I think about. And I feel lucky to be in that position.
Yeah, I have a similar thing where I was playing French horn in the band when I was in, you know, seventh grade through high school. And we played all these marches, and I always had to hit those offbeats. Every Sousa march, the horn part was nothing but offbeats. And I always thought, well, that really made it so much simpler when I became a mandolin player, because I totally understood the whole concept of offbeats. You know, listen to the tuba and then hit the offbeat, you know.
Yeah.
Well, since you brought up the drums, let's rewind the Matt Hutchinson tape a little bit back to your early days and tell us all about how you got started playing music. Well, before we do that, where exactly, I know you're in England, where are you thereabouts? And
yeah, so I'm in Southeast London.
Okay.
And I've been in London for 25 years now, maybe. And you know, this city is my home. But I grew up in the northwest of England, not too far from Manchester and Liverpool.
Yeah.
And my background, I started playing when I was 11 or 12. My parents bought an organ that sat in the house, and they decided that I should learn to play it. So they sent me to a piano teacher, but the only person they could find was also a drum teacher. And he said, do you fancy doing half your lesson on piano and half on drums? And I said, yeah, that sounds
heck
like
yeah.
And it sounded like so much fun that I eventually kept cutting down the piano bit of it and just doing the drum stuff.
How long ago was this?
I'm 50 in a few weeks. But
okay.
This was,
so when you were a kid?
In the mid 80s.
Yeah, okay.
And, and at that point, bluegrass music wasn't on my radar. My dad listened to a lot of different stuff. So we would have things like Johnny Cash albums around the house and a bit of Carl Perkins or Jerry Lee Lewis. But that was about as close to country as things got. There's a lot of Beatles in the house. I listened to a lot of rock as a kid. And then sort of fast forward a bit, and I picked up guitar in my teens because I wanted to play something that had melody and harmony to it, not just the drums. And then just, things developed from there. And I've dabbled with a few instruments over the years, but the real turning point was about 15 years ago when I left job, and as a leaving present, they bought me a mandolin. And I'd never said I wanted one. I'd never, I'd played acoustic instruments, and they knew that I liked country music and bluegrass and just acoustic folk music of all kinds. And they decided to buy me a mandolin. And I thought, I'd better learn to play it then.
Heck yeah.
And I did. And I started learning fiddle tunes and getting a bit more into bluegrass and going to a few jams and doing all sorts of other stuff at the same time. And then about a year ago in lockdown, I found myself just craving the sound of a fuller instrument and began picking up my guitar again and learning some of those fiddle tunes on guitar. And that's really where the start of this podcast journey came from. It's just taking this instrument that I played for years, not as a bluegrass instrument, and thinking, okay, maybe it's time to get serious and learn So this is a relatively new thing for me. I'm as a bluegrass guitarist, this is something I've only been doing for a year or so, but I've been playing music in various forms for, nearly 40 years now.
Yeah. Well, so like me, it sounds like you've spent the bulk of your time in bluegrass with a mandolin in your hands. Did you ever get into an organized band or performing and that kind of stuff, or was it just jamming in festivals and stuff like that?
So I'd go to sort of local jams, but actually most of the time I was playing mandolin in a band that wasn't a bluegrass band. I was in a nine-piece band that had a horn section and a fiddle player and a drummer. And we were playing a mix of kind of Eastern European folk music and sort of old-timey country. We sort of laughingly called it country and Eastern. And it was sort of loud, raucous, noisy music that happened to have a mandolin in it. And so the bluegrass was always a bit of a thing on the side where I'd learn some fiddle tunes and I'd go to a local jam and I enjoyed it, but I was never in a bluegrass band.
Well, who was the first bluegrass artist, let's say, that you listened to either seeing live or on a recording everybody seems to have like that moment where it hit them, smacked them up in the forehead, like, what is this? That experience of experiencing a full bluegrass band, full tilt, when I assume it has happened to you, when and who's like the first, sure enough, bluegrass that you listened to?
So I think for me, my route into bluegrass was through kind of acoustic music and singer-songwriters, and I've always been a big Steve Earle fan.
Yeah.
And I heard his Train of Coming album, that's Norman Blake and Peter Rowan, and I thought that's a great sound. And then The Mountain came out, and I was like, wow, like, listen to this. This is the playing and the groove and the timing and it's when it hit me that bluegrass is virtuosic music that sounds simple.
Now, is that the album that Del McCurry Band was on? I'm trying to remember.
Exactly. So it's the Del McCurry Band and Steve Earle.
Yeah.
So it's Steve Earle's songs, but Del McCurry's band.
Yeah, I have that. And they did a short tour, I think. I never have had any of those guys on actually, I had Mike Bubb on. He might have talked about that some. So any of you listeners, go back to the Mike Bubb two-hour marathon we did, and maybe he did talk about that. But that's a good start. Let me tell you, if you're hearing the Del McCurry Band, he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Ronnie McCurry on mandolin and Jason Carter on fiddle, and just that on its own is pretty mind-blowing stuff.
It is. Now, a lot of people that have gotten into bluegrass, in the time frame that you have kind of come into it, what I consider to be kind of backwards. Like, I've been doing this since the 70s, and probably back then people thought I was coming into it backwards because I was into Newgrass Revival and, you know, David Grisman and all that kind of stuff. So at that time, you know, the old timers probably thought, ah, you know, some hippie, you know, he's just, he doesn't know anything about Bill Monroe and stuff. But have you, since you got into it, have you sort of looked backwards and explored all the Flat and Scruggs and Stanley Brothers and Bill Monroe and all that stuff?
Yeah, totally. And you know, I love a range of it. And I've kind of dug, because it's sort of how music works, isn't it? You find something that's from your time and you dig back through the things that led to that, and you just pull on the threads and keep going. Yeah. And I'm by no means, probably everybody who listens to my podcast knows more about bluegrass than I do. You know, I'm early in my journey with all this compared to a lot of people. But there's just so much there, so much sort of rich history of songwriting as well as playing. You know, you go back to the Stanley Brothers stuff and the amount of amazing songs they wrote. You can hear another one and go, I've never heard that one. And that's an incredible song.
Yeah, it's you know, I run into, you know, hanging around at jam sessions and going to festivals. I'm talking pre-COVID. You know, you'd run into people who seem to know a good bit about bluegrass, but they thought, you know, Leftover Salmon or, I don't know, somebody like that, you know, that's their song. And I'm like, that's Bill Monroe, you know? Like, we did this thing one time opening for Fish, and I didn't know who they were. But they walked out on stage, and the first thing they played was Old Home Place, and they were a bluegrass band. It had banjo, mandolin, bass, and guitar. I'm like, what? But, you know, a lot of those Fish people might have thought, well, that's, you know, that's a Fish tune or something. I don't know. It's weird. It's weird. But I do encourage everybody to go back to the roots and try to understand the history of it, because it makes it all more meaningful, I think.
And I think, you know, one of the things that was really eye-opening to me was that you can trace it back to, you know, a specific decade and a certain bunch of people who created this music. And not that long ago, a lot of them were still around, and some of them still are. And there's not that many forms of music that are that new and feel so old.
Yeah, it's a very, to me, it's a fairly clear timeline. It's confusing because, you know, a lot of people did different things and different things with bluegrass music, but you can determine pretty close within a short time window of where it all began. I mean, it certainly, in my mind, began in the mind of Bill Monroe and evolved from there. Tell me a little bit about the bluegrass scene in the UK. You know, just as some goofball living over here in South Georgia in the U.S., I understand more or less, you know, the bluegrass scene. And I'm always interested to, when I bump into Europeans in particular. I've got a couple of friends that play bluegrass in Sweden. And I talked to Mike Marshall about the bluegrass scene there in Germany where he was. And didn't get into too much about the UK. I had Simon Mayer on. Well, you probably know who Simon Mayer is.
Yeah, great player.
Yeah, excellent. But he's not really a bluegrass guy, you know.
No.
He will admit that. But, you know, I'd just like to hear from you. What is the state of bluegrass? Not so much, you know, a la pandemic. We all know everything's a mess right now. But, you know, like up to that point, let's say March 2020, like what was the bluegrass scene? How prevalent is it? And, you know, what kind of bluegrass could a person find? And, you know, like, is it just something that would get tacked on to some kind of festival and there might be a bluegrass band around, or are there bluegrass organizations and whatever? I'm just curious, what is the story of bluegrass there?
Well, it's a really interesting one, and I got into a little bit of trouble when I started the podcast for exactly this reason. And I sort of had mentioned a couple of times that, you know, it's part of creating some stuff to jam along to is that it's not always too simple to find stuff here. And a lot of people, like, sort of rightly indignant, go, well, there's several you know, weekly jams in London where you can go and play bluegrass, and there's, you know, at least a couple of bluegrass festivals in the UK, and there's this, and of course there is, there's a lot of stuff, and because I've got into this relatively recently, I'm still discovering a lot of it, and it's amazing how much there is, you know, and it's the whole range. There's a, there's big sort of folk festivals like the Cambridge Folk Festival where you might get a bluegrass band. I've seen Lonesome River Band play there, for example, and then there's weekly jams that are straight ahead bluegrass jams, and there are jams that are more, you know, you might get some Bob Dylan songs, you might get some old time, a bit of bluegrass, somebody might sing a John Prine song, you know, you get that mix as well. So a bit of everything, you know, there's lots of it. It's a healthy scene and a lot of really, you know, really keen people and some great players, and there's so much out there. I can't wait to get back out and go and discover some of it.
Well, you know, one thing that to me has been interesting over the years, and this goes back to the 60s, really, would be bluegrass bands from around the world who would come to the U.S., almost like a pilgrimage. And I think, you know, a good example of that was the band Bluegrass 45 from Japan that came and played a lot of festivals around. And then we've seen a lot of, we've seen Italian, German, Swedish, Czech, bands show up in the U.S., and it's kind of a novelty to see, you know, kind of a what we would consider a foreign take on an American style, and welcome, open arms. But I can't say that I've ever encountered, and this would just be because I'm ignorant, I don't think I've ever encountered a band from England that came to the U.S., you know, kind of that way and did the festivals and, you know, experienced, you know, the hills of old Kentucky and stuff. I'm just curious if you know of any, you know, England-based bands who have done that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a great question. I don't know. There must be, but yeah, definitely when you know when I watch the bluegrass documentaries and look on YouTube and read about bluegrass, you see those stories of the Japanese bands that came over, and there's obviously a really thriving bluegrass scene in the Czech Republic and an instrument making scene that kind of goes along with that as well.
But
I don't know about British bands coming over and whether that's been a thing. It'd be interesting to know, actually.
I think the
interesting thing for me is putting the podcast out and seeing where in the world it's being downloaded. You know, I've had downloads from 100 countries, but the bulk of it, 75% of it, probably comes from the US. And then it's European countries and a few people in Australia and New Zealand, and then the rest of it spread out kind of across the globe.
Yeah, that matches almost perfectly my podcast as well as my website with all my instructional stuff on it. Almost identical. I do get, once in a while, I will see a few in India, and just a rare dot here and there. I've got a little globe thing on my website that, you know, shows like the number of hits from various parts of the globe. You can spin the globe and look, and I'm still waiting for Antarctica, but I did get a Greenland. I got a Greenland. So there you go. But it is amazing how, you know, maybe it's just people who are curious, you know, they're, you know, not, I don't know, you know, it's hard to know. That's the problem. It is a one way thing. You're putting it out and hopefully you're getting some responses from people, but it sometimes feels like you're yelling into a sewer pipe, and you don't know if anybody's on the other end actually listening. And, you know, I encourage everybody, first of all, go check out Matt's podcast, Bluegrass Jam Along. Check it out, download him, and then let him know what you think, you know, write to him, let him know you're a living, breathing human being out there and that you appreciate him.
You know, it's a funny thing. And I went through a sort of a little journey of discovery of my own along those lines a few years ago, just thinking if somebody puts something out, writes a book or releases some music or whatever, people are pretty available now. You can go to Twitter or Instagram and you can just say thank you. You can reach out to somebody and go, I read your book and it was really moving, thank you. And you don't need a response, you know, but I think particularly things that are created in one place and experienced somewhere else where there's no live feedback, people love to know that the thing they do is appreciated. I certainly do. I'm sure you do. And
I do.
So therefore everybody else does as well.
Yeah. There have been times, I swear, and this will probably happen to you at some point, Hopefully not. But there have been times I've just thought about, man, I'm just going to stop. Why am I doing this? I mean, week after week after week, you know, I'm like, why am I doing this? And then I'll get an email from somebody, or I'll get somebody sign up for my Patreon, $1 a month. You know, I'm like, oh man, now I have to keep going, you know. I love to hear from people though. And so anybody that's listening to Matt's podcast, let him know you're listening.
Yeah, do please. And it is great. And also the feedback is so interesting to hear from people, because I put this podcast out thinking it's so people can play along and they can't go and play anywhere else. But I've had several messages from people who are relatively new to playing, who said it's just great to have something to jam along to, because when I can go to a jam, hopefully by then I'll be confident enough to actually go and do it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, clearly what you're doing is going to appeal to people who are learning. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, some pro is not probably needing a 75 beat per minute whiskey before breakfast track, you know? And it's the same with me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not selling any mandolin instruction material to somebody who's been playing 15 years. It's just, you know, they don't really need it at that point. So you're going to have a lot of beginners, a lot of people who don't have a band, or maybe have never gotten up the nerve to pull it out of the case at a jam session. And my podcast, frankly, is oriented primarily to that same audience where, you know, I'm trying to help people that want to do it. Maybe, you know, I doubt I have very many listeners of people who are like, they've already climbed the ladder and they're way up there in their plate, because those people just go out and do it. You know, they don't really generally look for like, man, I wish I had the amazing slowdowner, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally. And so that's sort of, that's why I started with the 75 BPM thing, is that I wanted things to be accessible. And if you can play it at 90 BPM or 100 BPM, you're still going to get something out of playing it at 75. Because you might be working on breaks or improvising, whatever. But yeah. I didn't want it to be, I mean, the other thing is, I'm not the best guitarist in the world. I can't give you a backing track at 120 BPM that you're going to want to play along with. So it's part of my learning curve. I'm learning as well, and I'm sort of on this same journey with people, hopefully.
Well, but that you're making my point, though. If you put them out at 120 or 130, 140, you're not going to have hardly anybody that can play that stuff. And
yeah,
those
yeah.
that can, they don't need the backing track, you know.
But I am going to start doing some a little bit quicker, just for the people who've learned tracks and then want to push themselves a bit, and for people who might want. But, you know, I think you're totally right. I think the people who can play that fast, they're off, they're running, they don't need it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you're providing an interesting service. It's something that I've, you know, done. I got started doing jam tracks way back when I was working for this company called Watch and Learn, who put out all kind of instructional material. I mean, they did everything. A lot of bluegrass stuff, but they did keyboards and harmonica and electric bass and all kind of stuff. And they started putting out a series of CDs back in the 90s that were, you know, it was a disc full of blues tunes, blues, you know, and they'd have these session guys in Atlanta record this stuff, and there was just no lead playing on it. It was just, you know, keyboard, drummer, bass, and all that kind of stuff. And they eventually did bluegrass too. And they were peddling them, you know, on their website and stuff. And then when I came on board, we started producing a bunch of them. And so I know, you know, who uses them and which ones kind of sell and which ones don't, you know. And I still offer a few of them, but I'm glad you're doing this. It relieves me of the responsibility of trying to provide that sort of stuff, you know. For the beginner. And you've hit a couple of tunes that I've never encountered. What's that one you did not long ago? Shove that pig's foot a little farther in the fire, something like that.
Yeah,
I don't even know
that
tune. I don't even know that tune. Maybe I just started too late. That seems very popular these days. There's other tunes that it seems like everybody's playing, and I don't even know, like Squirrel Hunters. Everybody's like, hey, you know that Squirrel Hunters? I'm like, no.
That's the interesting thing. You know, I don't have this history of knowing what. Like, I'm sort of looking at lists of what I think are the popular tunes and trying to do ones that people would be learning.
Right.
And sometimes I'm just putting something out and, you know, I don't know if people play it or not. Yeah. The pig's foot a little further into the fire is tuned on love.
Now, are you,
and people have downloaded it, so I'm presuming that it's something they want to play along with. But
are you putting out the tab for what you're playing as well?
I'm not, and that was that's a conscious choice on two parts. One is that that would just take me extra time to do that I don't have because I have a full-time day job and a family. And but the other thing is I want to be quite clear that I'm not teaching anybody anything. I want these tunes and these tracks to be useful to you, whichever. But if you've got a version of the tune that you've learned from your teacher, from a DVD, from a book, from a recording, you can play it over these backing tracks. And I just want to be there to sort of facilitate people practicing and getting confident and having something to play along with. But I'm not in any position to teach anybody. I'm not that good. So I want it to be a clear line, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally does. And you know, when I first emailed you, I was trying to explain why I thought it'd be interesting to talk to you. And I was just curious, like, why would a person do this? And you brought up the point that you've got a day job. I'm just curious. I'm hoping and praying that you're not a psychiatrist, because if you are, I'm sure you got me totally figured out. But I'm just curious, what is your day job and what else do you do besides the podcast?
So I work in communications for a company called spareroom.com, which is a roommate finding website. It helps people find people to live with. And I've been doing that for 15 years. This is the job that I went to after that last job when they bought me a mandolin as a leaving present.
Yeah.
But music's always been part of my deal and part of my thing. And particularly during this past year when I've had a bit more time at home, I've sort of rediscovered a lot of why it's so important to me. And part of that is wanting to connect with people through music. And if I can't go anywhere and do it, a podcast is a great way of doing it, really.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, that's interesting. And just a little footnote for the listeners. Some of my listeners may know this, but you probably don't, is that my web store where I peddle my videos and ebooks and all that stuff is located in London. Sure is. And it's weird to think that, you know, I can be in bed 4 a.m. Some guy in Norway is downloading a video and he's getting it from London. And it's from, you know, it's from me, you know, and I just wake up in the morning and have an email from PayPal, you know.
Well, and this is the thing, because a lot of my downloads obviously come from people in the US and I'm in the UK. So I go to bed at night and wake up in the morning and there's a whole lot of stats of people that have downloaded stuff.
Yeah.
And the idea that while I'm asleep in my little bed in London, somebody in Colorado has downloaded a track, pulled out their banjo, and played along with something I recorded here in my bedroom.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool.
It's brilliant. It's such a cool thing.
We're very lucky. I mean, even this phone call that we're having right now, I can't even imagine the pipes and fiber optics and satellites and whatnot that are making this possible. Because if we just went back 100 years, we would both have our wireless sets, you know, our spark transmitters, a la Marconi, you know, trying to make it across the big pond with Morse code. And boy, things have changed so fast.
It is insane how connected we are. And I'm doing all this through my phone. You know,
Wow.
I mean, I could record, edit, release, and release the podcast on my phone if I needed to.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm
extraordinary.
I know this is just shop talk, but how is your podcast hosted? Who's hosting it?
I use a company called Buzzsprout.
Huh, never heard of that one.
You know, I upload everything to there and then it pings out across all the various places. I set all of this up relatively quickly. I did a bit of research, picked a company that looked decent and used them. You know, I've gone for the approach of having to do as little of that myself as possible.
Right, right.
Just from a time perspective. I sort of, when I set this up, I did slightly worry that I would spend all my time podcasting and none of my time actually playing the guitar, which is the point of all this. So I tried to engineer it in a way that, you know, I can do it with minimal extra stuff.
Yeah.
And so far, fingers crossed, it's working.
Yeah. I think, you know, just the relative shortness of the episodes makes it, you know, helps that. I mean, sometimes I'll do an interview or something. Interviews are the most complex because a lot of times it requires a little bit more editing, you know, where as opposed to me just flying solo, turning on the mic and yakking and belly aching and pontificating for, you know, 45 minutes or something. Those are fairly cut and dried, you know, but the ones that involve, you know, what we're doing today, and then making sure the levels are good and converting it to mono and doing, you know, you got all these things and inserting a little music segue between my intro and the outro and all that kind of stuff. There have been days I've, you know, got up, got started 8 a.m. and it's like supper time and I'm not done. I'm still, and then I have to listen to the whole darn thing, you know, which in your case, if it's 5 minutes, it doesn't take that long to listen to 5 minutes and make sure there's no glitches or something. But man, sometimes an hour, I'm like, oh man, I got to listen to me talk for an hour. So I'm envious.
But even still, I make mistakes. You know, I managed to release one of the episodes and forgot to put the count in for the track on, so nobody knew when the guitar was going to start. And I had to replace the audio. You know, it's.
I've played with musicians like that though, so you know, it's a good training. You just got to jump in and hang on. I think, as Briscoe Darlin said, did you guys get the, you know, Andy Griffith Show, all the reruns over there?
I don't know. It's something that's one of those things that I've read about since getting into bluegrass, but it's not something I've ever seen on TV.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's all probably easy to find on the internet today, but you definitely need to go back and check out some of the, you know, the Darlin family episodes where it's the Dillards are portraying. And you'll also find some episodes with Clarence and Roland White on there, basically Kentucky Colonels. They did some stuff on several episodes too, and it's really interesting. You should definitely go check them out. But you know, old Briscoe Darlin, he's my sage that I always rely on his sayings, because he would always be in there playing the jug with the Darlin family. So you definitely need to check out the any old Darlin family episodes. I think there's six or eight. Yeah, it's cool. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on here. I don't want to take up all your time, and I don't want my battery to die on the phone. But I to the listeners, I encourage everyone to go find his podcast. Oh, but tell you what, make it simple for them. Tell them how to find your podcast.
So if you just go to bluegrassjamalong.com, there's links on there to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you want to find it, whichever platform you use. They're all on there. So just go to bluegrassjamalong.com.
Perfect. I like it when it's nice and simple like that. And by the way, you mentioned picking on the porch. I just want to throw out an open invitation. If you ever decide, and I didn't ask this, and tell me if you have you been to the U.S.? Have you done a bluegrass pilgrimage? Or do you ever plan to? And if you do, you're welcome to come to one of my pickings out here at the barn. I'd love to meet you in person one day. I'm just curious, have you ever been to the U.S. and done that?
I've been to the U.S., but I've only ever been to New York through kind of work trips, really. But I would love to. I'd love to come over, and there's just so much cool stuff, festivals and, you know, guitar camps, and I mean, I would love to one day.
Yeah, great. Well, let me ask you this, too. Tell me, who are some of the bands that you listen to? I mean, if you're into bluegrass, I know you're listening to bluegrass. I'm just curious who some of your favorites are that are people out there playing today. Like, I'm a huge Third Time Out guy, Dale McCurry Band, you know, Lonesome River Band. I really like those bands a lot. I'm just curious, who are some of your favorites?
I mean, I love Punch Brothers. I love what they do with that sound and where they take it and what they can do with it. I think sometimes what I find really interesting is that there's some incredible material out there that isn't on people's albums, but you see it on YouTube, or and you know, you see videos of people just sitting and playing a fiddle tune together that isn't, they never sat and recorded it with anybody.
Yeah,
but there's so much amazing stuff out there. I love I'm With Her. They're not a straight bluegrass band, mm-hmm. but they sort of wander around that space. Brian Sutton is a bit of a hero of mine. I love listening to Brian, whether it's his stuff or he's playing with somebody else. And I'm really lucky that I'm part of the Artist Works program where he teaches.
Right.
And I get to, you know, I get a little bit of his wisdom directed my way every now and again, which is incredible. And often it's those little things where you find a video of, I don't know, Billy Strings and Molly Tuttle playing at a festival together.
Yep.
It's not something either of them have taken the time to record, but, you know, just hearing players together. David Greer, I think, is an incredible player.
Yeah, he's awesome.
I could listen to him all day.
Well, be sure you go back and dig up recordings of his father, who played banjo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, his father, Lamar, played banjo for Munro.
Ah, there's all these threads. You can just keep following it all back, can't you?
Yep, you certainly can. And, you know, again, I'm not telling you this. It's mostly to the listeners, and I've said this so many times. Go buy a book. You know, read a book. Get the book, Bluegrass: A History, by the guy's name, Rosenberg, I think. It's a little dated.
Yeah, I've got that. Yeah, I mean,
you know, you read that. And by the way, I was looking at that not too long ago, and I was wondering if you had ever run across Bill Clifton, a.k.a. William August Marburg. He grew up around Baltimore. And he was one of the early bluegrass people. I think he first started recording some tunes for Starday in like 55, 56, something like that. And he started one of the very first bluegrass festivals in America. Very early. I think it was just a one-day thing. But what's interesting is that in 1963, he moved to England. And he played there for, I think, at least a decade. So you might want to dig around and see if you can find some Bill Clifton stuff from the 1960s, early 70s. And he went all over the world. He recorded stuff with... There's a guy that has a podcast called, I can't think of the name of it. He's out of New Zealand. I listen to it every week. I can't remember the name of the show. Anyway, they had a band called Hamilton County Bluegrass, and Bill Clifton recorded with them, and they're from New Zealand. He's from Baltimore, but lived in England and just all over the stuff. You know, I just encourage you, since he did spend a good bit of time in the early days of bluegrass playing in England, that you might want to look him up and see what you can find.
Yeah, I'll check that out, definitely.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's been fun. Hopefully you will one day get a chance to come over to the U.S. and, you know, get some of this bluegrass stuff firsthand. I mean, I often joke, like, when I run into somebody like the Swedes, the guys from Sweden that have a bluegrass band, they've come over here a couple of times on these sort of pilgrimages. And I've always found it fascinating that I don't run into hardly anybody here in the U.S. that's playing Swedish folk music. But they're really into, you know, essentially American folk music, a la bluegrass. Anyway, I just think it's interesting and how the music has truly spread worldwide. And, you know, if Bill Munro had a dream, maybe that was it. Anyway, thanks for coming on the show. Everybody go check out Matt's podcast. Tell them that website one more time.
It's bluegrassjamalong.com.
Right on. Hey, Matt, thanks a bunch. And don't be a stranger. Stay in touch.
Yeah, will do. Thanks so much for having me on. It's been great chatting to you.
Yeah, man. Thanks. All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed that. Once again, we're hearing a little of that outro music. That's off of Matt's podcast. Y'all go scope it out. He is providing a valuable service to bluegrass pickers who are living in solitary confinement but still have internet. Also to beginners, I think it's just a valuable resource. And, you know, if you like his podcast, support his podcast, even just a little attaboy or a pat on the back, a little email, let him know you appreciate what he's doing. And that's it for this week. I will talk to you in the next episode.